We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Labor activism is on the rise in China. And here's just one sort of indicator. In 2008, there were almost 700,000 labor disputes in China that went into arbitration, and that was nearly double the number for the year before, 2007. And under Chinese law, if this arbitration doesn't settle the problem, then people can go to court. And in 2008, the number of labor cases in court was up 94% from 2007. And it does seem that the government of China is taking a fairly tolerant attitude towards this kind of labor protest because technically strikes in China are illegal. In this part of Focus, we'll talk a little bit about what's going on with the Chinese labor look at what it would mean for the workers of China and perhaps also for the economy of the world if China ever got to the point where they had independent unions, which are also currently illegal. It is a fact that China has more people working in manufacturing than any other country. And we have two guests with us this morning, and they're both joining us by telephone. Mary Gallagher studies Chinese politics, law and society, and comparative politics. She is a professor of political science and also director of the Center for Chinese Studies at the University of Michigan. She's been involved in a couple of projects that deal very specifically with this area that we're talking about. One, taking a look at the development of rule of law in China by examining the dynamics of legal mobilization of Chinese workers. The other project she's involved in looks at labor standards and practices in four regions in China. Also joining us is Manfred Elfstrom. He has taught and studied in China in rural Shanxi province. He then interned with the Carter Center's China Elections Project in Atlanta, where he followed the progress of village-level democracy. He also traveled to observe local elections and decision-making in southwestern China. After that, he was the campaign coordinator for China Labor Watch, and he was also program assistant at the Weatherhead East Asian Institute. Most recently, he was a program officer for the International Labor Rights Forum and was very active in promoting labor rights in both China and Pakistan. And this fall, he will be at Cornell, starting in on a PhD. And we're glad both of them could be with us here this morning. As always, questions are welcome. We do, however, ask people to be brief, make it a question, and do keep it on the topic. But if you could do that, the call is certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to email your question, you can do that, will-talk@illinois.edu. And Professor Gallagher, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us. And Mr. Elfstrom.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thank you. We certainly appreciate it. I hope, Professor Gallagher, am I pronouncing your name? Great. Okay. I just asked because I guess I once knew a fellow who pronounced it Gallagher, and I just want to make sure I...
That's the Canadian pronunciation.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm really pleased both of you could talk with us. Just as a way of starting out, maybe I'll start with Professor Gallagher and then Mr. Elson, you can comment too. It certainly seems to me that what's been going on here in China in terms of worker protest, activism, some strikes, is very unusual, and it's really quite interesting. And nothing quite like this has happened before. Am I right that's true, that in fact nothing quite like this has happened before?
I would have to say no, it's not quite right. I think some of the things we're seeing right now seem to be new and different and unprecedented. But labor, just kind of basic labor strike, labor conflict, has been going on in China for a long time in the manufacturing sectors on the coast, really since the 1990s. They've often been for different reasons. There's been periods when China was restructuring companies, particularly the state-owned companies. There was a lot of protests related to that in the late 90s. But even among these migrant workers that you see in the Honda strikes, for example, and other strikes, they've protested significantly at other periods of time since really the early 1990s.
Mm. And when you, just to be clear, when you use a phrase like migrant workers, what that means is that these are people who lived maybe more in the interior areas of China who moved to the coast because there was work there.
Right. These are, you know, often former farmers or the children of farmers who are moving to either manufacturing or services in the urban areas.
Well, then, is it, let me just ask the question, since you're saying that this kind of thing has been going on now for some time, is there something about where we are now, particularly what's happened over the last few months, that is qualitatively different than what's happened before?
Some of the things that have been changing more recently, I think, have to do with their demands. I think their demands are increasingly more proactive. They may not just be protesting against being fired or very extremely bad conditions, but rather, you know, for example, right now, for pay increases, right? They have an emboldened sense that they have more bargaining power and they can press for better conditions and better wages. I think also we're starting to see some differences in the way that they organize and in the way that they communicate amongst themselves.
Well, let me switch over to our other guest, to Manfred Elfstrom, and tell me what sort of things strike you as being particularly interesting about where things are now with labor activism in China.
Well, as Professor Gallagher said, it's the existence of strikes isn't so unusual, but their organization is, I think, unusual. And what struck me was that, at least in the case of the strikes at Honda plants that you've heard about and most people have heard about, there are very clear demands for reform of the local trade union branch. And, of course, China has a single trade union federation, the All-China Federation of Trade Unions, which is closely linked to the party and government. And the workers making very explicit demands of the trade union branch is fairly new.
And am I correct that, in fact, independent unions are would be illegal in China?
Yes, in essence. I will go back and correct one thing you said earlier, though.
Yes?
Strikes, to my understanding, are not illegal. The right to strike was stricken out of the Constitution in 82, but there's some ambiguity about whether you can strike, and it really seems to be up to the local government to decide whether a particular strike is illegal or not.
Professor Gallagher, could you clarify that for me?
Yeah, no, what Manfred said is right. It's not clear in the Constitution now whether or not it's illegal to strike. It was taken out as a right. There's an acknowledgement, I think, by the government that these things happen all the time, but it's not clearly legal or illegal. There are many, many different laws that they could invoke to say that a demonstration or a strike is illegal, for example, disturbing social stability or threatening the state in some way. So there are many ways that they can rule against certain particular strikes. And Manfred is also correct that, you know, trade unions, all trade unions in China must be affiliated with the official trade union.
If you look at the way that, again, particularly recently, and I, as not someone who follows this closely, the thing that has caught my attention is just what's going on over the last couple of months, particularly with strikes at these plants in the coastal areas. And as you say, particularly there have been strikes at plants where they make auto parts for Honda and Toyota. There, I believe also there have been some actions going on at plants where they make electronics, things like computers and the iPod and the iPad and stuff like that. What seems also to be interesting is what the reaction of the government has been.
I think the government has, for several years, been much more sympathetic to worker demands, particularly the central government. They've passed laws recently that are more protective. And at least, you know, in their speeches and in their written laws, they are much more protective and sympathetic than they had been previously. Although China, as a socialist country, has always said that, you know, it should protect its workers and give them fair working conditions. The the government is conflicted because local governments in China really need to continue to attract foreign direct investment and domestic investment, they need to grow the local economy, they need to increase employment. They're not very sympathetic to these strikes, and they tend to be the government that needs to crack down on them, and that often does crack down, and did crack down in some of the Honda strikes. So the central government is much more protective. The local government, on the other hand, which really has to deal with the issue more directly, has been a little bit more repressive.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I would go back to Manfred Elvstrom. Could you talk a little bit about just what for Chinese workers, what working conditions are like?
Well, the conditions vary considerably. A couple years ago, workers in illegal brick kilns were discovered to be working under forced conditions. Some of them were mentally handicapped people who were horribly abused. They slept essentially in the kiln areas, as I understand it. The incident that drew so much attention really spurred a lot of conversation in Chinese society. So that's sort of at one end of the spectrum. At the other end of the spectrum, there are some fairly high-tech manufacturers, even down in the light industrial areas in the Pearl River Delta. And workers at some of those places will make considerably more than the minimum wage. I suppose most workplaces would fall somewhere in between. So long hours, 12 hours a day or so, usually 6 days a week, sometimes just 1 or 2 days off a month. Workers tend to live at least down in the Pearl River Delta and the export processing zones on the campus of the factory in dormitories and eat cafeteria food that they complain about. They live 10 or 12 people to a room. At some factories, they're subjected to military-style organizations where their dorm rooms are inspected and they're docked pay for messy dorm rooms or for checking into their rooms late or for arguing in line and so on and so forth.
Hmm. And it's also, I guess, my understanding that when you talk about wages for those people who work in manufacturing, while it's certainly true that they earn substantially less than workers in the developed world in the United States or Europe, that actually compared with other workers in developing Asian countries, places like Vietnam, India, Pakistan, Cambodia, that the Chinese workers make considerably more money by comparison.
Well, that's probably true in general, and Vietnamese and other Southeast Asian workers are starting to show up in Chinese factories down in the Pearl River Delta, actually, as illegal workers. But then there are a lot of nuances, too, and the Vietnamese trade union is arguably a little more proactive than the Chinese trade union, even though it's an official government-connected union, just like China's.
Hmm. Let me just very quickly introduce again the guest for anybody who has tuned in. Manfred Elvstrom has taught and studied in China. He was the campaign coordinator for China Labor Watch, also program assistant at the Weatherhead East Asian Institute. Recently, he served as the program officer for the International Labor Rights Forum, was active in promoting labor rights in China and Pakistan. This fall, he'll be at Cornell, starting in on a PhD at Cornell's School of Industrial and Labor Relations. Also joining us is Mary Gallagher. She is professor professor of political science at the University of Michigan, where she studies Chinese politics, law and society, and comparative politics, and has done some work and continues to work on the issues of labor in China. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, I just wonder, Professor Gallagher, it seems that particularly here, the kinds of workers and their activity that we have been hearing about recently are maybe these people are some of the better advantaged workers in China, in the sense that compared to some, their working conditions will be better, their wages will be better, and that they seem to be pretty good at organizing and advocating for their own interests.
Mm-hmm. I think the strikes that get the most publicity, both domestically in China and then in the international media, tend to be the strikes that occur at well-known companies, multinational companies often, with workers who are sophisticated enough to contact the media, get support through blogs and through chat rooms and through their connections with journalists to gain some sort of publicity for their cause. They also are just much more, they're better educated and they tend to just understand some of the legal rights that they have at the workplace. It's also the case, though, that the domestic media in China, which is not a free media, can report on strikes that happen in foreign companies more easily than they can report on strikes that happen in Chinese companies. So I think strikes have been occurring, both during the financial crisis because of layoffs and because of decreases in pay, and then also in 2009 as the recovery took place in China for wage increases. These strikes have probably been occurring at a whole range of factories, but we tend to hear about the ones that are occurring in the multinationals.
Hmm. Well, that's an interesting point because I guess it was my understanding that the Chinese government really discouraged Chinese media from reporting on things like this at all.
Right. They eventually, both the Honda strikes and the Foxconn suicides, there were not, I don't believe there were strikes in Foxconn. Foxconn is a company that is a big Apple supplier and received a lot of attention because of the iPhone is made there. What happened at Foxconn was that there was a spate of suicides in a very short period of time. That was reported on in China briefly, received a huge amount of domestic attention in China, almost more than the strikes, because it was so dramatic an act for these workers to do, and it was, I think, it created a conversation in China about what kind of work are people entitled to. Mm-hmm. Foxconn is not a low-paying factory. It pays fairly well, but it is an incredibly stressful and intense place to work.
And that's it seemed to be the case that as a result of the work experience that was in fact what was the motivating factor behind these suicides.
Well, there was a lot of speculation. I mean, it's very difficult to know, and it's probably a whole range of factors for why single individual or a group of individuals commit suicide. In the media, there was some interviews with family members that seemed to indicate that it was a combination, probably, of some individual factors. And then a workplace, and this is also where they live because they live in the dorms, a place which was incredibly alienating.
Yeah. Elfstrom, anything else that you might want to say about, particularly, I guess I'm interested in this how it is that workers are going in an atmosphere in China with the constraints they have, how it is that workers go about the business of trying to organize, say, apart from the formally recognized unions?
Well, like Professor Gallagher said, they have their online tools of communication, so there is a service somewhat like Instant Messenger, like Skype, called QQ in China that you can form groups within and have conversations, and those groups can get shut down, but you can form new QQ groups. More immediately, there are ties that form very quickly in dormitories and on shop floors between people from the same hometown or from the same province. And sometimes those ties take a semi-formal form in native place associations, much like happened actually at the beginning of the 20th century in Hong Kong and Shanghai and other places. Mm-hmm. And then there are just incidents where a worker is bullied by factory guards, where someone's humiliated in some way, and a strike just happens spontaneously and spreads through the plant. Now, those strikes tend to burn out, in my understanding, in a day or 2 days. But there are strikes that just happen entirely spontaneously as well.
Mm. I do think it's interesting that it seems that people there in China, just as we have seen other people, are using social networking and using cell phones and internet and the ability to exchange information that way. They're using that tool just like a lot of people in a lot of other places are using those tools as ways to organize.
Right. They don't have access to some of the tools that people have in other countries, like Twitter, for example, or Facebook, both of which are blocked in China. Obviously, one can get to those via proxy servers, these internet servers that redirect you or trick the internet censorship regime in China into thinking that you're outside of China when you're logging into these sites. But on the whole, people don't use those proxy servers, and they don't have access to some of the tools that people use for organizing here in the States, but they have their own tools in China as well. Hmm.
We have a caller here. Why don't we bring them into the conversation, someone who is listening in, Urbana, on our line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? In the early 90s, I had a company that one of my vendors said that if I had the product made in China, I could save a lot, you know, make more money. So I had a friend who spoke the language and had dealings with people there. So he went over to China, like it was 94. And when he came back, the product was a piece of cast metal. And when he came back, he explained to me that the cost was good. And he said but that people were treated like slaves. And I thought, unfortunately, I went ahead and had the product made there. But my problem with in the early 80s, I remember the Koreans doing something very similar because they were, too, being exploited, the South Koreans, by the Western manufacturers, Europe, the United States, probably some Canadian firms. And that sort of turned around because the government was democratic, I guess, if you're going to call it more of a democratic government versus these communist governments in Vietnam and in China, et cetera. And recently there was an article in the New York Review of Books about a guy who has spent 5 years in Vietnam and talked about the work relationships there and how the people were basically, you know, enslaved by companies. And I have a tendency to want to use that term. I think you're right about saying that unions are state-sponsored, so they're not true unions in the sense. And the Foxconn thing, Apple Insider had a lot of information about that they had gotten from insiders in China that they used to get, you know, predictions on new Apple products. And there seemed to be a lot of just basically people working 18-hour days and, you know, basically living in the plant. And, I mean, it's just amazing what this race to the bottom, and you're basically killing people. I mean, it's an obscenity, and I don't quite understand why the people in the United States are not told this and are not, I mean, you know, just say, I won't buy this product because of that. But these companies know this. I mean, I knew it, and I feel really bad about doing that for that vendor. But, I mean, it's like... It's just amazing. I'm sorry about the politicization of this, but I just wanted to say something about that. Thank
sure.
you.
Well, I will get some response. Maybe I'll go to Manfred Elfstrom first. You can respond any way you like to the caller's comments.
Well, I very much agree with the caller's sentiments. I'm not sure that refusing to buy products from China or from Vietnam or from another one of these countries will help the workers there particularly. I think what does need to happen is greater communication between labor activists in the States and elsewhere, maybe more so in other developing countries, and labor activists in China, and sharing of ideas. And I think people who are thinking of manufacturing in China, like the caller, need to be hooked up with people who have good on-the-ground information and good instincts about responsible manufacturers there. I would just add as a side note, too, that some manufacturing, well, and this is not my area of expertise, but I understand some manufacturing is coming back to North America and not for reasons of labor costs so much as for shipping costs. And I imagine it depends a lot on the product and how much value added there is to it.
Hmm. And Professor Gallagher, anything that you would want to add?
Well, the caller raises a lot of really important issues, and I think, you know, some of the criticisms are exactly right on target about some of the problems, and in particular, excessive overtime. That's a huge issue in Chinese factories. I think, though, if we see it historically, one thing that's important to remember, I guess, for these workers in manufacturing for the most part since the 90s. So most of these people as migrant workers as coming from the countryside, they have very low expectations and are often, you know, they're not being forced to migrate and forced to work in these factories. They're doing it voluntarily because the alternative was worse. So the alternative, which was staying in subsistence agriculture, to them was worse. I think if we look at this as a process, you're starting to see migrant workers who no longer compare themselves to, well, if I had stayed and had been a farmer, they now say, I want to be an urban citizen, I want to be treated like other people in urban Chinese cities. So they have much, much higher expectations, and that's starting to change the way they think about their work, and they have higher expectations and higher demands on their factories. So I think, you know, compared to the early 90s, there's been some improvement in many factories, not all factories. It really also depends on the product. Another thing that's interesting, I guess, in just in terms of American consumers, is that in the 90s, people started to ask questions about where their clothing comes from and talking about buying sweat-free clothing. Not many people ask questions about where their computers come from. And often when you go to a computer factory, you don't notice that it's a sweatshop because it's cleaner than an apparel factory. It's sometimes air-conditioned because of the products. And so you need to pay attention to other things, like what kind of overtime are people working? How are they being compensated? What happens if they make a mistake in electronics factories that are higher end?
Hmm. Well, you know, you touched on something that I think also is very interesting and wanted to talk about, and that is how it is that over time, particularly as the average age of the workforce goes down, so we're getting younger people, we have people who have expectations that are different from those that their parents had,
right.
And that they want a better quality of life. They expect better working conditions. They expect better wages, and they're less willing to put up with things that perhaps their parents might have put up with. You wonder to what extent that those kinds of increasing expectations may well translate into more kinds of grassroots organizing or grassroots activity, and that is something that maybe over the long term, it may take some time, would actually be a force that would improve conditions for Chinese workers.
Yeah, I think that's right. If these workers, and it's not only that they're better educated, it's that they are a smaller group. The youth in China is becoming, after a big boom, it's going to become smaller because of the one-child policy, where it has already become a smaller proportion of the workforce, and that's only going to increase as time goes on. They are often the single children, or they come much smaller families. Parents have spoiled them or put more emphasis on their development, and when they leave the countryside and they go to the cities, they don't think like their parents did, and they don't have the same future envisioned. Often these rural migrants nowadays, who have almost no experience working in the farms, really want to become urban citizens, permanent citizens, and that's something that the Chinese government needs to change. They need to change their policies about how rural people in China can legally become permanent residents in urban areas. It's not like the United States, where you can move freely from city to city or town to town.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me turn back here to Manfred Ellstrom. I wonder to what extent also in China there is some possibility of mobility, in the sense that here in the United States, to one extent or another, if you're in a job that you're not happy with, you can just say, well, I quit, and go work somewhere else. Is for how many Chinese people is that actually an option?
I think it's a strong option for people who've picked up and moved along with many others of their generation to the Pearl River Delta. As Professor Gallagher said, the number of workers is smaller. There is a huge appetite for labor among factories there on the coast. I think it varies some by industry, but a lot of them are short of workers. So workers can pick up and move to other factories in the area. They risk losing their last month's pay. Sometimes they're still forced to make deposits when they sign up for a job that they lose if they quit early or if they quit at all. But they do move quite frequently. They often only work at a factory for for a year or so, and when they return home to the countryside to celebrate Chinese New Year's, they'll come back to a new factory often. So there's a lot of mobility between factories. I don't think there's a lot of mobility in terms of climbing the rungs of the factory management. I mean, certainly some workers work their way up to be managers, but there are a number of college graduates also desperate for work who are filling the more white-collar slots in factories. Mm-hmm.
Something that I have read about, and you can tell me whether this is true, is that also there has been some, for these people who moved to the coast, the cities of the coast, to work in manufacturing, there actually has been some growth in job opportunities for those people back closer to where they came from and presumably where they still have family, and that actually now some of the manufacturing plants on the coastal areas are having a problem because people are leaving and they're going back home, and now suddenly some of the factories in the coast have more jobs than they have people wanting to take them. Is that actually true?
Yeah, I think that's true. There are a couple different reasons for that. Beyond the factories moving inland and employing people closer to their hometowns, there was massive infrastructure spending by the Chinese government as a stimulus measure when the global financial crisis began, and workers are employed building bridges or railway stations or whatever closer to home in addition to working in factories. And even before the financial crisis began, the Chinese leadership made some big decisions in terms of cutting centuries-old taxes levied on farmers, in terms of spending more on rural services, still not enough, but more than in the past. And those things also made it easier for people to stay home or alternately for people to return home for a period if they just weren't finding the ideal job in the city before returning to the city later.
We're a bit past our midpoint here, and I guess what I would like to just very quickly for anybody who might have tuned in, I think I should reintroduce our two guests, Manfred Alvstrom and Mary Gallagher. Manfred Alvstrom has taught and studied in China in rural Shaanxi province. He interned with the Carter Center's China Elections Project in Atlanta, where he followed the progress of village-level democracy. He also traveled to observe local elections in southwestern China. After that, he was the campaign coordinator for China Labor Watch and also program assistant at the Weatherhead East Asian Institute. Most recently, he was the program officer for the International Labor Rights Forum and was active in promoting labor rights in China and Pakistan. And this fall, he'll be pursuing a doctorate at Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations. Also joining us is Mary Gallagher. She's professor of political science at University of Michigan, where she's also director of the Center for Chinese Studies. She studies Chinese politics, law, and society, and has also been involved in some projects looking at the development of rule of law in China by examining the dynamics of legal mobilization of Chinese workers. She's also involved in a project looking at labor standards and practices in four different regions of China. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller in Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Hi, I'm sorry I was taken away in the last few minutes, so if this is redundant, I'm sorry. But I wanted to know about what kind of statistics are available on the sort of more wildcat strikes that people hear about. The statistics you started at were all the legal kind of procedures. What kind of, and the other point I wanted you to talk about, and maybe you have already, is the multinationals that are there, how much I would presume that the Chinese government would be harsher with them cracking down on MNC outfits, enterprises, and maybe less so in the sweatshop sort of places. But this high repression, low wage circumstance that China has been for a while is probably changing. And you know, does Motorola have to deal with Wildcats? I don't think so. But on the other hand, there have been some kind of international campaigns. I wonder if you could address that. And I'll listen off the air.
All right. Well, I guess maybe I'd start, Professor Gallagher. Can you make some kind of response?
Sure. Statistics on strikes are really difficult to get. They're not released in China. You may find in news reports or in some journals every once in a while some local numbers that'll give you a sense. One of the numbers that you hear a lot was a number that came from the Ministry of Public Security in 2005, which was 187,000 mass incidents in 2005, which is a huge number. And it was an indication in the speech that he gave or in the interview, I forget what it was, of, you know, serious social instability in China. Not all of that of those mass incidences have anything to do with labor. A lot of them are about land and redevelopment of land that often leave people badly compensated or move to places they don't want to move. But labor is a big portion of the strikes and demonstrations that that we hear about. In 2008, the statistics that you read at the beginning of the hour were related to the legal disputes. And with a legal dispute, you don't know whether or not there was a strike or not. Sometimes there is and sometimes there isn't. The question also about is the government more willing to crack down on workers and multinationals, I would say no. In fact, they're much more willing to allow pressure on multinationals to build up a little bit in the media and sometimes through organizations by the workers themselves to push for better conditions. And I've seen this in McDonald's stores in China. You saw this with Walmart and Walmart's resistance to unionization in China. These types of issues about unionization, issues about conditions, are rare, and particularly issues about strikes, are rarely covered in the Chinese media when they occur in a Chinese factory. They're much more likely to be covered when they happen in a foreign factory.
And Mr. Elfstrom, I don't know, anything you want to add?
Well, I think Professor Gallagher's right on that. I think one exception people talk about sometimes is whether Taiwanese factories get a little bit of a soft treatment in order to further relations between Taiwan and the mainland. But I don't know that anyone has any statistics or anything to back that up.
Professor Gallagher, I wanted to have you talk a little bit about the legal changes, the law that went into effect in 2008. And I sort of made reference to the fact that there now is this possibility. There's a system, so there can be some arbitration of labor disputes. And if that doesn't work, then people can go to court. And that sort of my understanding that this law that came into effect in 2008 was something that the government did actually as a way to try to head off strikes and other kind of labor actions to give people an avenue for trying to get some attention for their grievances. Can you talk a little bit about this and whether or not this was this really something new?
The 2008 labor contract law is a supplement to the first law, which was passed in 1994 and went into effect in 1995, the National Labor Law. The National Labor Law was really the first law to set into place the arbitration and litigation proceedings for labor disputes. So workers have had that option. What the labor contract law did was, and actually another law that was also passed at the same time, the labor dispute mediation and arbitration law, these laws, generally speaking, are more on the side of workers than they are on employers. They increase the statute of limitations for workers to bring suits against their companies. They reduce the fees. And they also made it more difficult for companies to fire people because they're becoming more expensive or their contracts are changing from fixed term to non-fixed term. Chinese labor laws, most Americans are probably surprised to hear about it, but most Chinese labor laws are better than the American labor laws in terms of the kinds of protection and the degree of protection that workers get. However, the real problem with Chinese labor laws is that they're not implemented or enforced very well. So these laws were passed. They were very well publicized in the media. Lots of people knew about them. Workers knew about them increasingly. And then the financial crisis happened. And so local governments, which are tasked with actually implementing the law, really held back in 2008 and 2009 in trying to put these stricter laws into effect. Workers, however, really responded, and workers continued in 2008 to file lawsuits or arbitration filings against their employers. Mm-hmm. So the law has had this big effect, I think, from the bottom up in terms of workers becoming emboldened and, you know, having a sense that because these laws have been passed, that there's more support for them in the courts and among government officials.
Well, that certainly seems, if you look at the numbers, that you see a pretty pretty significant increase, at least in the numbers that I've seen, if you compare 2007 and 2008, in both the number of disputes that are in arbitration and then the numbers that the courts are handling.
Yeah, it's a huge problem because, of course, they don't have the capacity. So what's happening now is there's huge delays, both at arbitration and in the courts, and huge frustration among workers that these laws do not seem to work very well when they actually try to use them.
Yeah, I think that also it certainly is something that I have read that this it's been a real problem for the Chinese legal system because it just can't cope with this volume of activity.
Yes, that's right. And I guess I
can turn back to Mr. Elstrom. Have you seen or do you know that this now possibility that workers have at least this avenue to talk about what's going on with them and with working conditions has actually yielded any potential, any positive benefit for workers?
Oh, I think it has. One amplifier of these laws is the growing sector of labor NGOs in China. Depending on how you count them, there are dozens or just a small handful of labor NGOs in China, but they often take as their core task legal education. So they bring workers together in small groups in factory neighborhoods or at their own offices if they have formal offices and do mock arbitrations, read through model cases, answer workers' questions, and those workers then go home and spread the word about what they learned to other workers. How much this amplifies the laws, I don't know, and how many workers really come in contact with these NGOs, but they are one way of making these laws have a little more teeth or raising expectations of the laws. I know right after the labor contract law went into effect in 2008, attendance at some of these NGOs' trainings really went through the roof for a short period.
Mm-hmm. It seems, though, Professor Gallagher, that what you were saying before is that from place to place, what government is really willing to put up with, or in terms of activity and organizing for workers, it really varies a great deal.
It does vary. I mean, it's pretty clear from, at least from my own perspective, that there's no sense from the government that independent trade unions is an option. I think the route that they've taken instead is to try as much as possible to improve the way that the official trade union functions and to think of new ways that it can interact with workers and get confidence from workers. Workers have very, very little confidence that the trade union at their company would ever help them. You see a little bit of change in that. But structurally, the trade union is just not well situated to really represent workers, particularly when something happens like a strike. And this happened during one of the Honda strikes where it was alleged by workers that the trade union that came down from the local offices actually beat up some of the workers instead of representing them in a bargaining or negotiation meeting.
Yeah, that's also something that I've heard about, that actually that people who are involved in the official union have been involved in discouraging extracurricular activities by members.
And even up until a few years ago, it wasn't unusual if a worker filed a lawsuit against their company, the trade union chairman would come to represent the employer in the arbitration proceedings. So it was just laughable that the trade union was even setting itself out as a representative of workers.
When there was a complaint, the union would actually weigh in on the side of the employer and not in the worker.
And it's still often, I mean, trade union officials at most firms in China are not elected. They should be elected according to the law, but they're not. They're often appointed, and they tend to be mid-level managers in the human resources office. So you basically have someone who's representing you who is also the person who can hire and fire you.
Hmm. Do you think that it would be possible anytime soon, anytime in the near future, that the government would be willing to tolerate a truly independent trade union?
No.
No. In a word, no.
There are ways that workers and sometimes companies think of ways to develop committees or councils that allow for greater communication between their employees and management. And they may take on some role that a union would take on. But once you go beyond a single company, and if we're talking about particularly an organization that would organize workers across workplaces, the government would be very, very interested in that. They'd be very concerned about it. And if it happened, it would be considered to be a threat.
Mr. Elfstrom, I mentioned a couple of times that you were involved in the International Labor Rights Forum and that you were involved in promoting labor rights in China and Pakistan. What sort of things are happening in what ways are labor people, organized labor from outside of China, what are they trying to do with or for Chinese workers?
Well, one thing they've done for a long time is support labor NGOs in China, give them sort of basic capacity building training, you know, helping them manage their finances and manage their staff better, help them really evaluate how they're reaching out to workers. So that's one thing people have done outside of China. Increasingly, chunks of the American labor movement have reached out to the All China Federation of Trade Unions with the hope of connecting with some of the more forward-thinking people within the organization and seeing if there are ways that the American unions and the Chinese union can work together in regards to specific companies or more generally to further reform within the ACFTU. A lot of organizations, including my former employer, work through universities to train labor lawyers, to bring together arbitrators and judges, to talk about ways of better meeting workers' needs for impartial hearings of their cases. And, of course, there are many groups who conduct factory investigations, like China Labor Watch does, like the National Labor Committee does, name and shame multinationals that are guilty of especially egregious abuses. Mm.
What would it mean for workers outside of China and maybe also for consumers outside of China if there could be a really significant increase in wages and better conditions for Chinese workers? I mean, really, it's clear that would be good for Chinese workers. What would that mean for everybody else?
No, go ahead, man.
No, you go ahead.
Go ahead, Professor Gallagher.
I think it's very unclear about what will happen to the prices of end products if Chinese wages continue to go up at a fairly rapid rate of, say, 10 to maybe 12 or 13% per year, which is what they've been doing recently. And it really depends also on the product. China is becoming less competitive for very labor-intensive low-end products, and we may see some of that investment go to other countries, to countries in Southeast Asia, perhaps even to countries in Africa. It may also go, probably will do both, will also go to inland China, which is much poorer than coastal China. So in all regards, rising wages in China are not bad. I can't think of any for anybody. For American consumers, we may pay slightly higher prices, I imagine, for some things. But when you think about, for consumers, when you think about when you buy something from China, it's good to ask about how it's made, and not just because for workers, but also for the safety of the product that you're consuming. So I think if consumers think about that as something that they can do, not just because they're being altruistic toward workers in some far-off country, but rather they're also consuming something that's made in a better way and is safer for them and healthier for them, I think in all regards it's a win-win situation.
And Mr. Elfstrom, you want to add something?
No, I think Professor Gallagher put it very well. I think China also has some advantages other than low wages that will prevent factories from ditching the company in the short term. It has very good infrastructure. It has strong personal ties that have been built up over years between companies and local governments. And some of the big initial investors in China after it opened up, and still some of the big players in business in China are overseas Chinese. And I don't know how quickly they'll want to switch to Bangladesh or somewhere.
Well, I got the point where we're going to have to finish up. I guess I'm interested in a sort of a final thought. I'll turn back to Professor Gallagher and talk about, you know, where things stand now and what really have we seen significant changes in worker activism in China. I mean, it initially you said, well, it's something that's kind of been going on for some time now.
Right.
But is this an accelerating trend, do you think?
Why it may be different is that it's sort of the social context of the strikes and the workplace in China hasn't changed dramatically since the 90s. But what has changed, I think, is the demographics of the workforce. And also, I think the government has become, and partly the government has changed because of public pressure on it from Chinese citizens themselves who are worried about this issue. So it's a kind of confluence of not just the social aspect of the social context of work, but it's also workers are becoming emboldened because their bargaining power is increasing as the workforce shrinks and as migrant flows also are going down. And then you also have the government becoming more supportive. So those three things together, I think, is an indication that this is a process that is in transition.
All right. There, we're going to have to stop. Our guest, Mary Gallagher, she's an associate professor of political science and director of the Center for Chinese Studies at University of Michigan. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Manfred Elfstrom, a former program officer at the International Labor Rights Forum, has also worked at the campaign as campaign coordinator for China Labor Watch, going on to work on a PhD at Cornell this fall. Mr. Elfstrom, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.